Program, we focus on subjects and topics that we primarily find important and interesting, but also material that is intended to make you think and question. Many times this means the underreported, the controversial, and simply the other side of the story. Today we are going to talk about megalithic sites in Sweden. And by the way, while we're on the subject, if you've been following our website as of late, redicecreations.com, you know that we've been covering the very interesting story of the unidentified object, whatever it is, found by the Ocean X team from Stockholm in the Baltic Sea. It's down on the ocean floor, about 80 meters. It's about 270 feet. And it's really muggy water there too, by the way, difficult to see. There's oxygen deficiency in the Baltic, and they struggle with poisonous algae blooming, specifically summertime. It's been destroyed, I think, by years of farming fertilizers, topsoil being drained away into the ocean, and other crap being dumped into the Baltic there. But there's been some interesting pictures coming out. I wonder what it could be. The stone object that it's determined to be at this point is about 60 meters in diameter, 200 feet or so. It could be anything from a old, very old stone monument, maybe even a meteorite, or something that the government has been trying to hide and cover up, just like the Estonia shipwreck. They haven't given away the true location of the object, but fears other might be looking. One of the team members, Dennis Åsberg, stated recently that Russians and Americans were conducting military exercises in the area. Very interesting. This is on international waters. This last trip, satellite phones, cameras and other electrical equipment stopped working when they got close to it. It's really strange, but we'll keep monitoring it. Hope to see some more results soon and get a chance to talk with a member of that team. Today, though, we are going to talk about a monument in the most southern tip of Sweden, in the area of Kåseberga in Skåne, or Scania. It's called Ales Stones, 67 meters long, formed by 59 large boulders weighing up to 1.8 tons each. Dating differs, as always, from 5,500 years old to about 1400 years ago. With us to talk more about this is Nils Axel Mörner. He is the former head of the Paleogeophysics and Geodynamics Department at Stockholm University. He retired in 2005. He was president of the International Union for Quaternary Research Commission on Nanotectonics in 81 to 88. He headed the INTAS project on geomagnetism and climate from 97 to 2003. He is also a critic of the IPCC and the notion that the global sea level is rising. He was formerly the chairman of INQUA, as I mentioned before, the Commission on Sea Level Changes and Coastal Evolution, and led the Maldives Sea Level Project. Mörner is also known for his support for dowsing. He is well versed in stratigraphy. His publications span over 30 years. Right, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Nils Axel Mörner. Very good to have you with us today. First of all, Dan, thank you for taking the time talking with us, Nils Axel.
No problem. It's an interesting task, so I do it with pleasure.
Really good. This is going to be great. We are primarily going to talk about Ales Stones, or Ales Stenar, as it's called in Swedish, with this in focus, and then we'll see how the how this site connects with some of the other phenomena, some of the things that you've been studying and researching together with Bob Lind, of course. And I'm going to let you talk a little bit more about Bob after this, of course. But why don't you introduce yourself to us first and let us know in what field you are an associate professor in, what you've studied, and also how you came to begin your work here with Ales Stones, Nils Axel.
Okay. I'm a geologist and geophysicist by training. I have spent enormous work working with sea level and earthquakes and earth rotation and gravity and a lot of different things. And my institute and my students up at Stockholm University from where I retired a few years ago. I have written more than 500 scientific papers and lots of books, so I am working a lot. But I have also a wide cover of different subjects. So I think that was the curiosity is, of course, one thing which is high on my agenda. And curiosity caught my attention to Arne Stene, and that's how Bob and I became friends and worked together.
Ah, really good. Was Bob already doing the work at the time when you got together with him?
Yes, Bob is an interesting person, and he deserves a program by itself in some way. He was a pilot, a private pilot, and had an accident, and he nearly, it's remarkable that he could come back. And with forces, he succeeded one day to come up to Arne Stene, and I became interested in the close relationship between the stones and the setting of the whole object with relation to the solar motions through the year. And it was a well-known, he's an artist and amusement person, Hans Alfredsson. He had been in the Shetland Island, and when he came back, he wrote a story. He came 2 days before the winter solstice. So the first thing he did, he went to Arne Stene and sat down there with a few herrings and saw that the sun came up exactly over the sternstone. And he said, why don't archaeologists with an astronomer investigate this then? So Bob came there, and his intention was caught for it, and his lifetime was caught to it. There has been other scientists there and got the same view, but here in Sweden, archaeoastronomy was a strange subject, so people couldn't understand it. But he worked there for many, many years, and think of this, he was an amateur, but I mean, there are excellent amateurs which becomes better than professors.
You bet. Or, yeah.
And that's the interesting thing. The only interesting thing is the product. So what he did, for example, he took a photo every single sunset and sunrise through a whole year, but over many years, of course. But it is a remarkable work.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable work. It's a thesis in some way. So at any rate, then he ran into some problems with people which didn't believe him, and he told me this. This is a story he told me. One morning he woke up, and he thought, oh, Nils Axel, he will save me. And that was quite funny. And then he dragged me down there, and we began to work, and I got very excited and thought, of course he is correct. That's no problem on that. But it was also an exciting topic. One thing gave the other. And you could, so to say, dig deeper and deeper, and both vertically and horizontally over this southeast Sweden, which is called Österlen. And Österlen, we rapidly found out that it has been a very interesting place in Swedish and also European Bronze Age.
Indeed, very, very interesting. One thing that Bob has done, of course, is he's turned this theory into something empirical, something which is, yeah. You know, he studied this obviously by himself. By the way, I want to mention this. We've tried to get Bob with us many times, but unfortunately, partially I think because of his accident as well with the
yes.
with the plane, his English is not the best, and it's
exactly.
Somewhat difficult. So
he was a good English speaker before.
Yeah.
But with the accident, one language stayed, and he had problem with the others. So I am giving his voice too. So I speak
That's
for
right.
both of us.
Really good, Nils Axel. All right, so why don't we just kind of lay the outline, if you will, a little bit, you know, for this particular site. If for those who've never visited, maybe not even seen a photo, what we're going to do, I want to tell you this as well, by the way, yeah. Nils Axel, we're going to have photos up on the website to go along with this program, so people can look at that with the sketches from above, etc. Yeah. So I think it will be fairly easy for people to understand and see this. But why don't you briefly just describe what it is?
First of all, it's the form of a ship, and it's nearly almost exactly 70 meters long and 19 meters broad. And it is set up by 57 stones, an unequal number, 57 stones. And it's resting very, very monumentally up on the hill, just at the seashore. So it's like the ship. If you go a little inland, you can see the ship, and you can even see the ship on the horizon, like it is there, it is going away or coming, whatever you want to do. So it's mythologically, it's easy to imagine things. And many authors and artists have been inspired by. They have wonderful poems written about Ale stones.
Yeah. Now, where does the name come from? Ale, who is that?
Ale is holy god. It is tells you immediately that it has something to do with religion.
And is it the Valhalla? You know, also
no,
religion.
It is,
no,
it is holy. It's holy and it's sacrificed. And it's the stones from them. But it looks like it's one person, but of course this is much more than it. But all the stones, and it should be better with the capital stones also, because it's, for me, it's a name. At any rate, this wonderful monument up on the top. Today it's a wonderful monument. During the wartime, we unfortunately had soldiers hiding close by, so it has been a bit vandalized through the periods. The first time we had a beautiful picture of it was from 1777, and we can see where the stones were, and it was restored in 1916 very, very carefully. And it was, so we know which stones had fallen and which were in place. And those who are in place, all the important stones are in place.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was a difference in interpretations of what it was. Some archaeologists, I don't say all, because some people say all, but as a matter of fact, it's just a few persons, which archaeologists by training, they say, this is a grave, and it is from the Iron Age, maybe even into the Viking period.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, no, for heaven's sake, this is not correct. There is not a trace whatsoever of any graves there. And now, 3 months ago, the Board of Antiquity has said, yes, no, it is not a grave. So that is gone. But 1 year ago, it was a big thing.
Yeah, you guys have been, sorry to interrupt, but you've been fighting quite a bit about this, right? Both you and Bob.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. But I make it a little, I don't talk too much about that side.
You focus on the victories.
We have the positive, we have the positive side, exciting side.
Yeah.
We say it is from the Bronze Age, and it's a calendar.
That's
a grave,
right.
It's a calendar.
Yeah.
So, therefore, it's important a day, this day. The sun goes up right in the middle of the ship. There are two stones which are a little different. Right in the middle, there comes the first beam in the morning. And then it goes, and then it sets just exactly behind the steam stone. Oh, so that isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that couldn't be coincidence. And in the winter solstice, the sun rises right over the stern stone, and it sets in the middle of the ship towards the southeast. And then you have also at the equinoxes, it goes east-west and right line. And all those has been recorded by Bob Lind. But it's even more the number of stones that are so that you can follow the how the sun moves. And each month is three stones, and it is 30 days. But the last one, then it's a little extra space, and then it becomes 35 days. So altogether we have 365 days. And this is perfect calendar, which with Phoenicians and the Egyptians had exactly that type of counting. So this is also, it cannot be a coincidence. But this is absolutely impossible. Then on the top of two of the most important stones, you have cup marks. And one which is four, and then the other three. But the sight line gives you, the one of four gives all the major four solar positions, and the one with three goes right to where the sun rises at winter solstice.
Mm-hmm.
So again, those must have been put on the stones when the stone was erected. Okay. But some others say, no, they were old stones from the Stone Age. It had been reused, so it happened to be cop marks on it.
Hmm.
But we think that is, of course, this is impossible. I mean, you talk about, again, statistics. What kind of possibility would it be to have such a fantastic alignment? I mean, they just discard all knowledge of statistics. It cannot be like that. And then they say, oh, and there are some cop marks which are below present sediment surface. And we say, well, yes, of course, but there's no problem because we have different land surfaces. When the monument was erected, it was about half a meter or 70 centimeters, differs from place to place, of lower.
Mm-hmm.
And there we have a very nice old land surface. I mean, I'm a geologist, so I can trace all these things. And I cannot understand how they can say that it humic soil goes down from the surface down 70 centimeters. This is impossible. Humic soil is just at the surface. 10, 20, at the most 30 centimeters.
Okay.
But if you have several soils, it just means that you have a stratigraphy. You have one bed, and then comes another deposition, a soil, and a third deposition. And this is the difference. So at the basic surface, we have old land surface, we have charcoal and settlement, which are much older than the monument. We
mm-hmm.
are 5,000 years old. Wonder. But we can see this. Into that they erected the stones. And last year we had an excavation where we found the imprint of one of the big stones. And I excavated that one. It was 3 meter long, over 3 meter long, and 1.2 broad, and half a meter at least thick.
Yeah.
So close by. Moved it to the place, erected it, put stones around it. Very soon after, sand started to blow. We had a change in climate, and we know when this change in climate occurred. It occurred 500 to 600 before Christ. It's a well-known horizon. It has been dated at many places in Sweden. We have dated it very nicely in Heimdall stones, but we hadn't dated it here in Alestina. We could just say that, aha, this must be the same sand. It filled the imprint of the stone which had been removed. It filled the ship. And into that, and of course it became a soil later on to that, into that, in the Iron Age, they put a pot with some food and some bones. They had was, of course, dug into it. It was, and that was the second horizon. And then they said that Märta Strömberg had found charcoal and bones under.
And she, by the way, Nils Axel, she is, what is she? She's the official.
She is the one which made the basic in the investigations for many years.
Okay.
She had about 42 small diggings or so, excavations, and many years, but never came to opinion about the age, surely.
Okay.
She has did six radiocarbon dates. We have we have made eight. So we have published, we have six which are just, we have just got this, not published.
Yeah, yet. Yeah. And there's another way you can come to the conclusion about the age as well, which has to do with the, well, that's about the procession.
Yes, I'm coming to,
go ahead, go ahead, Nils.
But let us finish this with the stratigraphy,
yep.
Because this is important. They claim that they had found charcoal and bones under one of those stones. That the 14th age is identical with the age of the food in the pot, and that was standing above, hanging in the sand layer which had blown into it.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought there's something wrong here. We cannot have the same age underneath and in there. It is impossible. It's against stratigraphic laws. But then again, after Christmas this year, we found the original sample bag, and on that original sample bag, which is at the Osteological Institute in Stockholm, it was stored. There it's written. It's not underneath. It was 70 centimeters down at the primary, dug into the sand, aeolian sand, sand blown material, and put on the old surface. So that was one indication.
Mm-hmm.
Then we interviewed one of the two men which have made the excavation, because the scientist was not present. She went to a friend and didn't take part in this important digging.
Okay.
She said, dig down. And he said, we went down 70 centimeters or so. When we came to the stone foot, I mean, that is the stones which were placed around the base, to put the stone in position.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not underneath it. Certainly not underneath it.
Right.
Then they stopped and they had found some black material which they put in a sample bag, and that's the sample bag which we saw, and that was one dated. So not at all underneath the stone, beside the stone. And it was written, sample from beside the stone. So then all this divergency has gone. So it's much better, I think, what we are saying. We have this stratigraphy. Two things have happened which backs up. This is my stratigraphy. But as a geologist, I work with stratigraphy.
Yeah.
This last winter, we had charcoal in this sand dated, and I got 550 before Christ. So it is very nice stratigraphy. So that's one date. The other is, I said that now, tonight and tomorrow night, the sun will set right over the steamstone. But right is right. It's not exactly. It is, if you say, it is a few centimeter at the side. And is it like that? Because the further back in time you go, the sun changes a little, of the reason that the angle of the earth is changing, the tilt, obliquity of the earth is changing by time. The cycle is 42,000 years, but even here it is a small factor. If you measure this and check it, it comes out that it was 700 years about before Christ. And Bob had said that two, three years ago, that this is my best calculation. He has recalculated in the book we did, and we got a very beautiful charcoal date, which got 785 plus minus 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the equation goes very well together in favor of our interpretation.
It sounds like it, and what you're describing here is obviously the precession of the equinox. And I also want to mention that at the time of this recording, it's right smack on the summer solstice. So it's not only timely; it's an excellent time to witness this empirically, right there on the site, of course. And I was down there not long ago at all, and looked at this myself, and it's a magnificent monument, as you said. How, for those who haven't seen it, again, we're going to put up some photos with, you know, to go along with this interview that people can look at. But how big are the stones? How do we know how much they weigh? The Stern stone is one of the biggest.
Okay, so we go to the stones. Stern and steam stones are of a different material. They are what the geologists call quartzite. Quartzite is a sandstone, but a sandstone which is where the grains are only quartz. So we call that quartzitic, quartzite. That rock, we know precisely where it came from. It came from Brantevik, 30 kilometers away. Probably it was formed, it was transported on a raft at Brantevik. We are just finishing a work there. There was a little cove, so it was a very natural little harbor for them to send out those blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly the same stratigraphy and facies of the quartzite. So we know that there's no other place. It's only there. And it has been broken out of the bedrock, because the upper surface has been polished by the ice, but the side has been broken off. And we are even working at a place where we think we have found the quarry, but that's a little too early to say anything about it.
Okay, 30 kilometers, stone Nils Axel. That's pretty far away, 30 kilometers.
Yeah, but think of the stones. They moved for Stonehenge. When enormous stones over large distance.
But I know.
A couple of tons, 5 tons maybe.
Yeah.
But on a raft, landed it underneath where it's now erected, and then dragged it up in one or the other way.
The
question was, should it be dragged up the shortest way, shortest and steepest way, or a little longer way and less steep? We have not finished that yet.
Yeah, I think we should mention as well the area is Kåseberga, yeah, correct? That's the area we're talking about.
Yeah, this Kåseberga, that is big. moraine deposits from the Ice Age. So that deposits were became into being about 13,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has been land area with a lot of morainic blocks in the top. And those blocks were then collected by the people. And they are, must be nearly 3 meters long in order to be large enough to be placed in the ship. And they collect the closer, the better, of course. But as it's so many, they had to cover quite a large area. So it was quite a heavy work, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I was there, I was just amazed at the. Yep. Well, I mean, the area is fantastic too. It's so beautiful down there, and it's. I don't know if it's the most southern tip, but it certainly feels like it.
Very
when you're
cool.
There of the on Sweden, looking down to the towards the ocean, and it's up high as well, and you have a great view from the ocean. Yep. Down south there.
It's about 40 meters above sea level.
Yeah,
and I mean it's just a few. 200 meters less than 200 meters to the shore. So it's very steep, eroded cliff.
That's right. And do you think that is part of why they chose this location to do it here? Is it just a perfect place to do it, I guess?
Yes. But I mean, there is a history before that. Because if it is correct that it's about 700 years before Christ, it's the very end of the Bronze Age. Up further away to the little north in the same area, Österlen, we have the remarkable grave, the Kivik grave.
Yeah.
And close by that we have Heimdall's stones. And Heimdall's stones is about 1500 years before Christ or so. And so is the Kivik grave. So we have a history here. And then there's another ship, which is Stenhed, beautiful ship. Heimdall stone is a circle, but we have all the alignment in it. So that's an interesting story.
Yeah.
And this is the monument we have in southern Sweden. In England, you have this remarkable monument of Stonehenge, which was older, also built, so to say, in a similar technique, huge monolites which have been transported over long distance. And we have shown now that it's a connection between those two. And we have said that Stonehenge has got a younger daughter, and then with a little but
yeah.
So much more beautiful. Because we think, as you said, it's very beautiful.
It sure is. Okay. And so let's talk a little bit about the relationship. And the site has been referred to as the Stonehenge of the North, or Sweden Stonehenge, I guess, as well, right? So.
Yeah, of course. So you can say, yes, because they are monolites and so. But
yeah.
Nothing was known in any direction until a year ago. Sure, a year ago. We presented for the first time. Because, we have the big ship. Form and Stonehenge is a circle.
Yeah.
But if we see other things in the ship, we have certain important stones which have special marks on them, of cup marks. They form a rectangle, and there were outlying stones and so which form a circle. So we have a rectangle, we have a circle, and then we have the first beam of the sun. This morning, at summer solstice.
Yeah.
Three components. And then Bob thought, remembered, I have seen something like that at Stonehenge. So then he went to Hawkins, 1963, Stonehenge decoded paper. And there he took, it was a sketch, unfortunately. We saw that if the basic thing is Aubrey Circle, it's a circle, four station stones, they form a rectangle, and then comes, of course, the big sun line at summer solstice. Again, three components. And they looked very similar. So what I did, because I'm working with computers and so on, I took Stonehenge and made it transparent and just superposed Stonehenge picture on Ale Stena.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no difference. They smack on. The solar alignment, the circle, and the rectangle. They were perfectly superposed. And then we wrote the paper, which have just been published in the International Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics. And that had raised quite a good an interest. But that's very, a completely new thing.
Wow, interesting.
So
sorry to interrupt, Niels Axel, but did you have to scale one of these up or down?
Yes.
To be able to fit it?
Stonehenge is a little larger, so I just shrinked it a little.
Okay, yeah.
But the proportion, the only interesting are proportions. And the proportion in Stonehenge is done with a so-called megalithic yard.
Yes, exactly.
And then comes the funny thing, you know, when you started to measure the distances the Ale Stena, which no one had done before, it came out that it was very, very uneven figures. Of course, they should be uneven because the metric system didn't exist at that time. But we have our own measure here in Sweden for medieval time. And nothing of that. But if you divided it by the megalithic yard, it became absolutely equal numbers.
Ah, okay.
So we claim that not only have the same basic geometry, they also have the same system of measure.
So
this is a new thing.
So this implies that it's the same builders, perhaps?
Connection. But you have to, there is one thing missing in the story, that is that Stonehenge is about 3,000 before Christ up to 2,000. This one is in the Bronze Age. So it's really in the so-called late Neolithic time. We are in the Bronze Age. But if you include that there was something before, we have earlier Heimdall stones, we have the other, which are early Bronze Age, then it means the connection, yes.
Very, very interesting. Where do we need to take this then? We talked a bit before this recording, Niels Axel, about Mycenaean and Phoenician connections. Tell us a little bit about this.
Excellent. Because that was how I really became taken by this project. When we... that it was a Phoenician influence, that was not so strange. But the question is, when did it all begin? And I saw a coincidence, because with the Scandinavian Bronze Age, three things happened exactly at the same time. We got bronze from the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean graves, the Mycenaean graves, were flooded by amber. And amber came with the chemistry in the amber. It was known that it came from the Baltic and southern Baltic. The region in Österlen, where there is something called Ravlunda.
Mm-hmm.
Rav is the old Skåne name and the today's Danish name for amber.
Well,
it goes very well together.
Yeah, it does.
And from the waves of the sea, every day amber is being washed ashore. But there is more than that, because we have found old documents which were saying that there was outcropping amber where people collected back in time. And we are pretty sure where it is. And at the time of the Mycenaean and Phoenician sea level, I'm a specialist in sea level changes,
mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I could very easily reconstruct and find the old shore at that time, it went in and made a very nice embayment, perfect for landing, just where the amber was to be collected. So we have the amber, which is, we think, come from here. The third thing which happened was that all over Scandinavia, in the rock, they started to cut in pictures of very huge ships.
Mm-hmm.
Ships which we didn't have at that time. It would take nearly 2,000 years, or at least 1,000 years, we were able to build something similar. So ships, so I made one story out of it. Ships were coming over the from the Atlantic with bronze, and they took back amber. And we went further, that we said that it had been really a trading station in Australia. This is not a new idea. It was Sven Nilsson. He was a wonderful and excellent biologist, but in 1860, 1870, he said, oh, this looks also Phoenician, and there are names which are Phoenician. And in the grave of Kivik grave, there are two omega signs, and there are pictures which doesn't belong to Scandinavian tradition,
mm-hmm.
but fits perfectly well into the Mediterranean picture.
Interesting.
But we went further on this. So in Heimdall stones, we found the third omega sign. So these are the only three omega signs which exist outside the Mediterranean. We found delta signs and a lot of things which backed up the story. There are the war chariot, which is so typical for Mycenaean time. And they were invented there. It's also a sign of the Indo-European. And then we are 1,700 before Christ. And it was at least at three places you have this engraved in the stones. And those are about 1500 to 1600 before Christ. So it was very, very rapid transformation. We have various ornaments, the spiral, which has been imported. So there's so many things which have been imported. And there we think, yes, it was a trading station in Österlen. So the Kivik, and as I'm tracing the shore, the Kivik grave is located only 60 meters from the ancient shore.
We
have graves in Brantevik, and they are equally large, but they are gone by now. But they all have the same position, 50, 60 meters from the shore. We have some rock carvings beside that, 50, 60 meters from the shore. So I measured, we have leveled them. So there was a connection to the sea. And those places where we were good, you could land, that's where they have been, they have selected it.
Yeah. So can we, from these, points, conclude that we are talking about a seafaring people, maybe the Phoenicians then, it seems to be the influence anyway, and they have set up trading posts at different places around the Swedish southern coast.
Yeah? Yes, first the Mycenaean and then the Phoenicians.
Yeah.
Right there. Yes, that's what we claimed. And of course we were, some people thought it was not so clever. A week ago, late, it was a program here where a group of archaeologists had traced by isotopes the origin of the copper here in Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that we had no copper production ourselves. It all came from Mediterranean quarries. Oh, so that backs up our story, and many of the archaeologists were very surprised and changed their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, when, with the beginning of the Bronze Age, ships came to Scandinavia. They brought with them bronze, and they took with them amber.
Yeah.
That occurred about 1750 before Christ. In England, your Bronze Age started 2200 before Christ. So it was a bit earlier, and it means that it took a few hundred years, but 350 years without connection to Scandinavia.
Yeah.
And then in the Mediterranean, the Bronze Age started 3,300 before Christ. So they took 1,100 years where there were no connection between Mediterranean and England. And then it took another 350 years because there were connection with Scandinavia.
Interesting.
It's also interesting.
Do you think they had any kind of, I don't know what, how to call it, but trouble with the, were there any locals here at that time? And because, I mean, they managed to build this huge monument right here in southern Sweden. So what happened there, do you think?
That we don't know. There's a long period of time. And I think the erection of those monuments is faster than we can, we usually think.
Uh-huh, okay.
But the interesting thing that we had, people went out of Gibraltar in huge ship much earlier than we had thought before.
Yeah.
So the trading, we have to revise the trading travel story completely, I think.
I think so,
the Phoenicians were the first to go outside the Gibraltar. But remember, long before that, we had the stories about the Hyperboreans. That was the people of Scandinavia.
Yeah.
So they must know about it. And there they talked about the Eridanos, was a river with amber. And that looks to be our little river here where I was talking about, just beside the Heimdall stones. Where it was amber was in place.
Yeah.
And also being washed ashore.
Now, is there any way we can explain why they went to this trouble of building a calendar that monitors the sun, it describes the seasons and everything?
Yeah. First of all, we have to work on it. But, of course, one simple thing is as soon as people became farmers, they need to know the annual rhythm. If they didn't know that, they didn't know how to behave in a clever way. But here, it's probably more. Those people had to sail to another place far away. Maybe it had to do with the sailing tradition, sailing technique, sailing. There were more built into that than we may understand today. But yes, of course, to today, time, direction, that's important. So they could take the day of the part of the year, and also, of course, because they had north, south, they had seen it, and so they could have also the hours, and the hours, the month, and the annual rhythm.
Yeah, I see. Interesting. Is there, if they were traveling around, I mean, as you say, they're from Gibraltar, they worked themselves up, eventually up here to the Baltic Sea and England before that. Is there anything similar on, let's say, Bornholm or anything like that?
Yes, Bornholm. There, for example, you have ship, which is directed, so to say, to the Swedish area. It's going to the sunset at summer solstice.
Mm-hmm.
But there is just a few things. On our side, precisely connecting with that line, we have the sunrise at winter solstice.
So they
yes, that is correct. But the more we will see in it, for example, if you go to Stonehenge, they have found close to Stonehenge the boy with the amber necklace, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
The boy is about 1500 before Christ, and he has a necklace with the, 60 pieces of amber or something like that. So he had a connection for sure with Scandinavia to get the amber. Then his teeth has isotopic composition, which tells that his origin was from the Mediterranean. So again, you have travel 1500 before Christ.
Yeah,
it's Jane Evans, this woman in England, which is working with this inherited background from the stable isotopes of the teeth. So more and more are coming together. Outside Portugal, there are some old ports, but they were thought to be Phoenician. But when you dig deeper into it, they are much older. And that goes to our story. So the more we learn, the story becomes more solid. But, of course, earlier it was sort of, say, blocked. No one outside Gibraltar until the Phoenician. Now we say the Mycenaeans were there.
Yeah. Interesting. We're going to take a little break here in a little bit and obviously continue talking more in the next segment. There's many more components to this I want to ask you about, a little bit more about some of the other sites around in the area that you briefly mentioned, like Heimdall's stones and Stenhead, etc. There's a lot of fun things out there that people might not know about. But I want to give out some of the websites here that people can go and find more information. One I know, obviously, is Bob's website. I reckon that you have some of your work included on that, too. And that
maybe,
is simply allestenar.com. And there is an English version for you guys out there as well. We're going to link this up. Do you have a personal website or anything else where people can find more about you?
Yeah, I have it, but it was 10 years since I made an order of it. So there's nothing to work. And nothing of the archaeological thing is there.
Oh, okay, I see. What about the books? Are they only available in Swedish?
No. Yes, one in Swedish, but then we have our papers and scientific papers. We have them two in Greece magazine. Then we have this Stonehenge all the stones relationship that is in the International Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and that is. Can be downloaded free of charge.
And is that on the website I mentioned?
I don't have the. You can just go in on Google for International Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and then you find it was number one this year, and then there you just click download.
Okay.
You get a PDF of it. It's very simple.
Okay.
And then it's about this, the measurements of the statistical error in rock carving with respect to the sun, which is just on its way out in Journal of Archaeological Science.
Okay.
And also Google on that and then... And if there is any problem, you just write me or Bob. My email is mourner.poji.nu. And this is, if you ask me, I send it to you.
Okay, I'm gonna add these links and the email address you mentioned on the website there for people.
I send hundreds of things to people.
Sure, absolutely.
All over the world. Yes.
Very good.
Different subjects, so there's no problem with
that's right. I found the paper as well, by the way, on the on the International Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and it's called Stonehenge Has Got a Younger Sister, All the Stones in Sweden Decoded. So that's very interesting. I'm going to link that document up as well.
Thank you. Do that, because this is a good document, and it's some, it's free downloading, which is normally people charge him. But there you can just go in and download it.
Okay, very good. Really, really good. Stay with us, Nils Axel. We're going to take a short break here, and then we're going to continue with more in a little bit. We'll be right back. We begin to discuss the importance of the sun and the veneration of the sun that these ancient people had. Nils has found the connection between amber from the southern part of Scandinavia and to other cultures trading in the Mediterranean Sea, specifically Mycenaean and Phoenicians. For example, omega symbols have been found at three different sites in Sweden, and of course these are not being recognized at all. We discuss archaeoastronomy, the relationship to Stonehenge and stars. The constellation of the Swan has been found on one of the stones. Mörner also tells us about rock carving around the same area that lines up with the winter solstice, and from where he believed the stem and stern stones come from. He might have found the quarry about 30 kilometers away. That's quite a bit to travel. So if you want to hear more about this, tune in to our second hour, available in our members section. You can subscribe at redicecreations.com. It's very simple. All the details are on the website. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Peter Halldorsson from Iceland, then Helen Kallikov from Australia. Les Visible, Freeman, Janice Barcelo, Grunville of Melchizedek, Daniel Pinchbeck, Courtney Brown, John Irwin, and we also have a special on the London Summer Olympics with various guests. After this, we have Duncan Wordley, Joseph Atwell with Fritz Heed, and many more coming on the program. You're welcome to tune in again. We'll be back with more in just a few days. Thank you for listening and for staying with us. Now, we'll be right back with the second hour on Aarhus Stones.